I think we're joined now by Mahdi Nazim Roya. Are you there, sir?
Hi, Phil. I am here.
Good. We're delighted to be talking to you. You've got a book, The Globalization of NATO, and that provides a perfect backdrop, I suppose, to what is we want to make sure we ask you about today, the sort of developments in the Middle East. I want to remind people, too, that you went to Libya during the struggle there and helped really straighten out all the misinformation that went on about Libya, and you risked your life. And we think you're wonderfully qualified. You were on the ground, and now you've written this book, The Globalization of NATO. Maybe I should just ask you, something odd happened over the weekend to do with Libya. The government of Libya pretends to be unhappy, or maybe they are unhappy, that the Americans came into the country and took somebody. Are we getting the real story there? What happened? Do you know?
Okay, I want to. Can I expand on that question?
Go anywhere you like.
Okay, first of all, to be frank, there is no universal nationwide government in Libya, so we have to be clear about that. There is a nominal government for the whole country in Tripoli, which has no powers outside of their offices. We got to be clear about that. They have to balance things by making populist comments or trying to make populist comments while appeasing the United States and several of its key European allies, such as France, the UK, Italy, and Germany. So even if they were genuine about those comments, they can't do anything about it. They're not the real government of the country. Mm-hmm. And if they were genuine, it was probably because of populist sentiment, like they don't want the militias turning on them. They have no power in the streets. So that's one thing about that government. The other thing is that the country's divided. It's broken. And the United States has been doing whatever it wants there since 2011. We can look at Benghazi, where the United States has been helping export the weapons from Libya's arsenal to places like Syria and Lebanon. Mm-hmm. A boat was apprehended. Several occasions, actually, Libyan weapon shipments were apprehended. But I'm thinking right now about Tripoli al-Shams, or Tripoli of the Levant in Lebanon, mm-hmm. Another city by the name of Tripoli, not Libya's capital, but near the Syrian border. Like, Libyan boats were taking weapons there. So, I mean,
Tripoli to Tripoli.
Well, yeah, Benghazi to Tripoli or Tripoli to Tripoli. They came from Libya. Mm-hmm. And this country has been broken and has no real government at all.
Mm-hmm. And by the way, that's a subject I think you could be very helpful on. And people, I think, should appreciate all this talk about the U.S. doesn't, you know, have any intentions what they can do for a country. They like breaking them because they get to come and go and fly over them and do what they like, right? In other words, at least there used to be a sovereign country, and when you went to the leader, you were talking to the leader. Now they have this kind of playground. Wherever they knock a government over, it's like Somalia. Who's running the place?
They want chaos. They want insecurity internally in every area or region they go to. But they don't want absolute insecurity. They want a certain manageable level where these countries can meet their international obligations, let's say, or their or try to meet their export obligations to the United States. While they're always insecure, there's always infighting, and the United States and its allies can act as arbitrators of power. They can tilt the balance for whichever side would listen to them in that country. You know, I remember in 2011 when I went to Mexico. I remember speaking to a colleague from one of the universities there, and he told I'm going to give this analogy here. He said, "You can see Mexico; it looks very stable. We're meeting all our trade obligations, but thousands of people. There's a constant war in the country; are always dying. There's a constant war where he said a very large figure of people are dying, and it put me to shock because it's more than a lot of conflicts. But mm-hmm. it's not something that makes it into the press here. And the United States has actually been supporting that instability in Mexico. That's one of the ways it keeps control over the state of Mexico, the country of Mexico. And this is what it's done in Iraq. Mm-hmm. This is what it's done in Libya. This is what it's done in the former Yugoslavia. This mm-hmm. is what it's done in Afghanistan. You mm-hmm. know, Hamid Karzai, you know, he's refused to sign the agreement with the United States over troops from last I heard. And I think one of the reasons is because he thinks that the United States will side with the Taliban eventually. They've been talking to the Taliban. They allowed Qatar to open an embassy for the Taliban, mm-hmm. you know, in Doha. Mm-hmm. They could sell him out in a second, and this is the game they always play.
Yeah, and now, by the way, that they do, it's sort of this is the old the post-Cold War wet dream of NATO, right, that they can play both sides of the table. In other words, they can own a government, and they can own the opposition.
Yeah, they create their own counter discourses, and they control. It's like the dichotomy in the United States that exists between the Democrats and the Republicans. Or maybe you might have more than two sides, but in each country, they basically make sure that their bets are they hedge their bets. You know, they support in Egypt, they'll support the military, and they'll support the Muslim Brotherhood at the same time. Whichever one falls out of line, well, they'll lose support. Or enough support from the mm-hmm. United States and its allies, and that support will go to the other side, and the other side will have the upper hand. And once they forget that they owe allegiance to the United States, to Washington, the same thing will happen to them. And that is the modus operandi of the United States in mm-hmm. regards to these countries.
Yeah. And by the way, this is Mahdi Nazimroya, and the title of the book is The Globalization of NATO and Its Clarity Press. A highly recommended, valuable book to have, and is very apropos of our discussion. And, of course, this power that they've had and they've exercised in Iraq and successfully in Afghanistan and Libya has now come to Syria, but there things have not gone quite the way the game plan was designed, I take it. What's your assessment of the present situation now with the chemicals and the possible negotiations at Geneva II?
Well, the chemical weapons use in Syria looks very much like the work of, categorically, I'll state from my understanding that it's the insurgents. Yes, insurgents, not rebels. And rebels are revolutionaries, and revolutionaries mm-hmm. will not attack civilian infrastructure that is not political at all. They're not going to attack universities, innocent university students. They're not going to attack churches or mosques. They're not going to attack hospitals. They're not going to attack bystanders who have nothing to do with a regime. They're going to target political targets in the regime. From my understanding, it was these insurgents with the support of Saudi Arabia and the United States and Israel that essentially did this. I think that what organizations like Human Rights Watch say is hogwash. Mm-hmm. I totally categorically oppose their statements, and I don't think they're even qualified to talk about human rights. Mm-hmm. Since I was in Libya, one thing I remember very well about NGOs like Human Rights Watch was when they came into the country, their mandates didn't seem like they, from what I saw with my own eyes mm-hmm. and from what I heard, their mandates didn't seem like they were there for safeguarding human rights. They looked like extensions of the U.S. State Department. Yeah. I remember very clearly when Human Rights Watch arrived in Tripoli, I was asked to be at the meetings they held. I rejected it because I wasn't fond of the organization in the first place. But I do remember what some of the people in the meetings told me after they came out. And Human Rights Watch didn't really seem like it was there to guard human rights. It was more like negotiating for the mm-hmm. insurgents in Libya. So this organization is morally bankrupt to me. I see its statements about Israel. Like they don't say enough. They only say things when they know they'll be in the spotlight if they don't make statements. I've seen the statements they made in Lebanon, which have been very disgusting and biased in favor, essentially, of the March 14th camp of Saeed Hariri, who is a Saudi and U.S. client in that country, who's been helping destabilize Syria, whose political alliance and future party has been helping send arms into Syria, and whose members of his party are also wanted on criminal charges or for investigation in Syria because of their involvement with the weapons shipments and smuggling from Lebanon to Syria. So organizations like Human Rights Watch, I totally reject what they say. Amnesty International, I also have questions about what they say. Professor Francis Boyle, who was on their board, who was a member of Amnesty International, is one of the people who spoke out against the organization. He noticed that it's working for the State Department. These organizations, let me also categorize or explain something in depth about them before.
Sure thing. But before you start on that, let me just tell everybody again. This is Mahdi Nazim Royo. He's the author of The Globalization of NATO, Clarity Press. You're listening to Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM, and I hope I didn't interrupt you too long. Please continue.
No, one thing is, a lot of good people are part of these organizations, and they're usually people who volunteer. They're people at the lower levels, but the people at the top, there is political motivation behind their work. And, you know, it's very, very illuminating when, for example, you see the head of Human Rights Watch in interviews, for example, with the Russian press that comes to mind, saying we, when he's referring to the intelligence information and to what the United States is saying, he's saying we. From a critical discourse analysis point of view, which looks at linguistics, you would have to either analyze that this man means we because he's an American citizen, or we because he shares the same objectives as the United States, the government of the United States. Mm-hmm. And he does. When you see him speaking about the information that he hasn't even been validated, hasn't even been authenticated, he's speaking about U.S. intelligence information that even a lay person, after some edification about it, would reject. The U.S. report, that four-page report that came out, is nonsense. I read it. I've read the different intelligence reports, and by far the most professional report that's come out has been the ones the Russians wrote up. It is much, 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 much better than all of the other reports. I haven't read the UN report in depth, but I will. Mm-hmm. But something I should say about that UN report: the reason it doesn't assess blame, and the media doesn't really say why, it just points out that it doesn't assess blame because it kind of tries to make it look like the Russians and Chinese are behind it. But the reason it doesn't assess blame is because the United States, France, and Britain insisted that the UN report not say who is behind the chemical weapons. That's a very important detail because they knew at the beginning. Who asked for that UN the UN inspectors to go into Syria? It was the Syrians followed by the Russians and the Chinese. They're the ones who asked for it after the attacks by the insurgents, way before they went near Damascus. In Khan al-Assad.
By the way, just before you get to that point, isn't it true that the Syrians invited the UN to come and look because they said they had been the victim, the government, of a chemical attack, and that report hasn't been done.
The original reason why the United Nations inspectors were going into Syria was that what happened was the U.S., the British, and the French tried to politicize it. They tried to pull an Iraq-style move by getting a very biased inspection team to go in, and they were going to manipulate the basically what would happen, the whole process. Then the inspections were halted until the Russians and the Chinese could secure some sort of non-biased or the least biased type of objective inspections team possible. And that's why it took so long for them to get in. And the Syrian government, of course, didn't want to start being asked to provide evidence for things they can't prove. Like, prove to us you have no more weapons of mass destruction. Like they were telling Iraq, how can you prove something that doesn't exist? How can you prove a negative? And then, so the inspections were delayed because of this. But once they got in, it was the day that what happened, the chemical weapons attacks. And it looks very strongly it was the Saudi government.
Yeah, you'd have to be blind or just not paying any attention to not be suspicious. I mean, that's just too neat a coincidence.
The day that they arrived.
And then they shot at the UN personnel who went over to try to have a look.
They shot at the UN personnel. The UN personnel, the people they met, were all tied to the insurgents. The insurgents basically selected who they could meet. They basically chaperoned them. There are some discrepancies. One discrepancy in the report that came out was that there is no environmental samples of sarin gas in East Ghouta, but there is one area had no environmental ecological samples, but the people that were brought did have traces of sarin. So there's a discrepancy there. There's a lot of things that, because of the situation in the war, that you can question. There's a lot of things in the methodology that can be critiqued. You know, I'm not a specialist in that, but there are some discrepancies in that report. I haven't looked at it in detail, which I intend to do.
Yeah. By the way, Nazim,
we should keep in mind.
We are getting a new kind of culture is working its way into the UN and actually into international politics. Is that the U.S. seems to be less able to just kind of set these things up and control them. And they're getting pushback from several quarters. I guess that's people called the BRIC countries, certainly Russia and China, are just because of the experience you went through, the Libyan one, at least that's the marker they're using. They're saying no more of that. And I wonder, what's your assessment of this view that President Assad made? He said that, well, first we had the insurgents, then we had the outside money and arms coming in. Those two things have failed. Then we have, now he says, it's up to the U.S. to decide and its allies if they want to come for themselves and attack us. And it looked like they were going to do it. And I wonder what you think of whether they will eventually try, or are we going to go into a process where they try to create, force the insurgent representatives onto on the government, make them accept those people. What do you think?
I think that's very good, very important things that you pointed out. Actually, firstly, I think that the United States is a declining superpower. It should become very obvious. I think President al-Assad's assessment is correct. What I want to expand upon is, I think that the United States partially has been bluffing and partially is serious. It's been bluffing in the sense that it wants to threaten to do certain actions to get as much as it can. If the United States can get what it wants in Syria without wasting resources, assets, and directly getting its hands dirty, it will. So that's where threats come in. The other thing is that the insurgents, they're a plethora. There's so many groups. Mm-hmm. They don't have control over all of them. They can't get all of them to sit down.
It seems to be a clown show. We had a guy come here to Canada, and everybody, and his papers told us he was the leader. I've never seen the man's name again.
No, but okay, all right. The thing is, there's a lot of opportunists who all of a sudden nominate themselves. That's how, when these situations arise, there's people who who start presenting themselves as the leaders, saying we speak for all these people and all and so and so and so and so. Most of them don't, and they try to get as much support and funding. And governments like the federal government of the United States or the British government, they look at which one of these puppets is the most practical and the one that they can get the most out of. And that's how they work with these groups. Otherwise, a lot of them don't have popular support. Well, almost all of them don't have popular support on the ground. And many of them have very questionable credentials and backgrounds. You know, I question people that ask the United States to bomb their own country. I mean, it's very... Most people who ask the U.S. to bomb their own country don't live in that country.
No.
I think people will notice that. Whenever you hear groups saying, bomb this country, I'm from there, I want freedom, most of the time, those people don't live there. They don't have to live with the consequences at all. They're mostly, most of the time, they live
outside
the country.
You could not walk down the street safely saying, oh, that bomb that killed the people in your house, I asked them to do that. You wouldn't last 2 minutes.
No, you wouldn't, and it's actually really, really sad. It's funny, of course, but at the same time, it's very sad. You know, look at the people who ask for Iran to be bombed or for Syria to be bombed or for Libya to be bombed. I mean, most of those people don't live in those countries at all.
No. They most of them live in Virginia, I think.
They live outside the country. They might be living in Britain, or they might be living in Canada or the United States. They don't even have any... They're not even really stakeholders in a country. You know, if you don't live in a country and you're not present in that country, like, what type of a stakeholder are you? I'm not rejecting them as fully as stakeholders completely, but you have to question what type of stakeholder is this in a country, and why are they asking for it to be bombed?
Yeah, and by the way, if there's going to be a Geneva II that succeeds, they're going to have to put the guns down. That's very clear. The Syrian government says we're not talking to people who are killing our civilians.
Well, the Syrian government, there's certain groups that the Syrian government won't talk to. I'm going to refer to what their President al-Assad said before many months earlier. He said Geneva is where we're not talking to the puppets. We're going to go talk directly to the masters. The masters aren't these so-called Syrian opposition groups. The actual masters are the United States, Saudi Arabia, Qatar. That's what he means. He says we're going to talk to them, because these groups are proxies. They're groups that have been nominated and chosen to be the leaders of a so-called opposition. In reality, most of the members of the opposition in Syria and the real Democrats in Syria are on the side of the regime.
Yeah.
And the reason they're on the side of the regime is they don't want to be with criminals, thugs, murders, or they're against insecurity or international intervention in their country.
Yeah, very well said. Mahdi Nazimroya, the author of The Globalization of NATO from Clarity Press, and of course you can read him at globalresearch.org. Thank you very, very much, Mahdi. It's very informative.
Thank you for having me, Phil.
Okay, doke. Bye-bye. That's Mahdi Nazimroya. We'll take a quick break, and we'll probably hear something about Newport, Wales.